Louisa May Alcott. She didn't want to write Little Women.
Louisa May Alcott had moved to Boston. She had a job running a magazine. She had an apartment she loved. She had, you know, established a life for herself in Boston. But because of pressure from her father and the financial pressure from her family, who she always had to support, she moved back to Concord in 1868 and very reluctantly started working on Little Women.
That's Susan Cheever. We talked to her about her acclaimed biography of one of America's best-loved authors, Louisa May Alcott. And in the second half of the show, we listen back to my 2007 interview with Cheever. It's about the genius cluster of great American writers gathered around Ralph Waldo Emerson, which included Alcott and Henry David Thoreau. Cheever's book about them is American Bloomsbury. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In Little Women, Louisa May Alcott created one of America's best-loved characters in children's fiction, the spirited, rebellious, and creative Jo March. In a time when marriage and family was seen as the sole purpose of a woman's life, Jo questions whether there's something more, whether a woman can live an independent life, devoted to her own interests and talent. Alcott herself remained unmarried by choice, but she did not escape the burdens of caring for her family. Her father, Bronson Alcott, was a famous public intellectual, but he was a disaster at making a living. It fell to his daughter Louisa to turn her literary talents into the money needed to support her parents and her siblings, and hence Little Women. In her biography of Alcott, Susan Cheever explores the complex life of her subject as a woman, a working writer, and a daughter. As the title implies, Louisa May Alcott, a personal biography, Cheever found resonance with her own life in Alcott's. Her father was also a writer, the poet John Cheever. But she also feels the questions Alcott grappled with were ones most women still face. Susan Cheever is the author of numerous books, both fiction and nonfiction. In addition to her Alcott biography and American Bloomsbury, she wrote a biography of AA founder Bill Wilson, several memoirs, and five novels. Susan Cheever, welcome to Writer's Voice. You wrote this wonderful book about Louisa May Alcott. Little Women was one of my favorite books when I was a kid. I was a tomboy. I totally identified with Jo. But you say that Louisa May Alcott was actually reluctant to write Little Women.
Yes, she didn't want to write Little Women at all. You know, she thought of herself as a serious writer. She had written a novel. She had been a Civil War nurse. She had written an extraordinary memoir of what it was like to be a Civil War nurse. And when Thomas Niles suggested that she write a book for young women, she was very, very reluctant to do that. She didn't want to write a book for young women. And she wanted to write the kind of books that Emerson and her father and Thoreau wrote. So she put it off and put it off and put it off.
And what made her write it?
Well, Thomas Niles, who was her editor, was a very brilliant man in his own way, and he wrote a letter to Louisa May Alcott's father, Bronson Alcott, telling him that if or when Louisa wrote her book for young women, Thomas Niles would also publish a book of Bronson Alcott's. So Bronson Alcott then brought a great deal of pressure to bear on his daughter. Louisa May Alcott had moved to Boston. She had a job running a magazine. She had an apartment she loved. She had, you know, established a life for herself in Boston. But because of pressure from her father and the financial pressure from her family, who she always had to support, she moved back to Concord in 1868 and very reluctantly started working on Little Women. She stalled as long as she could, but eventually she just sat down and wrote it.
Her father, Bronson Alcott, we've interviewed you before about your previous book, American Bloomsbury, where you talk about him. He was part of, well, why don't you just briefly say a little bit about Bronson Alcott and the movement he was part of?
Oh, you're talking about transcendentalism. Okay. Bronson Alcott was an extraordinary man. He was a self-made man. He came from a farming family in Connecticut, and he moved to Boston, and he was a brilliant, brilliant educator. He was one of the few educators in the 19th century who believed that children had anything to teach adults. People before that, most notably Jonathan Edwards, thought that children were little vipers who had to be civilized by adults. And a new idea about children swept the world, actually, in the 1830s, starting with Wordsworth's Intimations on Immortality and quickly spreading to Bronson Alcott, who believed that children were born angelic and that as they became civilized, they became less and less angelic. So, of course, Bronson Alcott's schools were a lot more fun to go to than conventional schools. And he had three schools. His final school, the Temple School in Boston, was extremely successful. A book that was written about it was a huge bestseller in Boston and New York. All the Boston aristocrats sent their children to Bronson Alcott's Temple School. So first, he was an educator. When he was the head of the Temple School, he attracted a lot of intellectual attention. People came from all over the world to watch him teach, and one of the people who came was Ralph Waldo Emerson, who at that point was living in Concord. And when the Temple School failed, Ralph Waldo Emerson invited Bronson Alcott to come and live in Concord. The Alcotts had no money at that point. They didn't have many options, so they went to live in Concord, and at that point, Bronson Alcott became part of a group of intellectuals, Emerson, Hawthorne, Thoreau, who are now referred to as the Transcendentalists, although they did not refer to themselves that way.
Now, he thought children were angelic, but he had a different relationship to his own children.
Well, he had a different relationship to Louisa.
Right.
In other words, his belief that children were born trailing clouds of glory, as Wordsworth said, and Blake also said the same thing, of course, and that children were born as angels and slowly lost their divine aura as they grew older and were more quote-unquote civilized, was severely tested by his daughter Louisa, who was very mischievous, very impulsive, and very hard to discipline, not naturally obedient. So in a way, because he believed that Louisa was born as a little angel, she really tested his convictions and drove him a little bit crazy.
And he was pretty stern. He was a pretty judgmental, stern taskmaster. And yet, despite this, they had an incredibly close bond. In fact, she died just 2 days after he died. And on his deathbed, he said to her, uncannily, "Why don't you come with me?" And she answered, "I wish I could." So talk a little bit about this fraught relationship between them.
Well, they had a very close bond, but it wasn't such a friendly bond when Louisa was young. She was the mischievous child. Bronson Alcott believed that dark-haired people tended to be satanic and blonde people like himself tended to be angelic. Louisa was troublesome. She was a tomboy. She was mischievous. She was disobedient. She was impulsive. And they had a very close relationship, but not a very good relationship. And, you know, Bronson Alcott was one of these men who treated his own family as if family itself was divine. He created a myth of the Alcott family in which they were all Alcotts first and everything else later. And Louisa, of course, subscribed to that myth. But it wasn't until she became a Civil War nurse that he really began to see that she was an estimable intellect like himself. And so, you know, their relationship at the end of their lives is quite different than their relationship when Louisa was a child. I mean, Bronson desperately wanted to be a successful writer, and Louisa became overnight one of the most successful writers in the world. And that certainly changed the way he saw her.
And yet he had a very important influence, as you said earlier, on her even writing that book, which led to tremendous fame for her. I mean, she was already getting pretty well known, ironically, I think, for her children's books, for her children's stories. Is that right?
Not really. She published a few children's stories when she was very young in the 1850s, but really, in order to make money, she published a great many sort of bodice rippers, what she called her Blood and Thunder stories, under a pseudonym, A.M. Bernard. But the only other book she had published was, she had published two books. One was a novel called Moods, a very serious novel that didn't do well at all. And then she had published this wonderful memoir, Hospital Sketches, about her time in the Civil War.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Susan Cheever about her new book, Louisa May Alcott, A Personal Biography. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Back to Little Women. You say in the book that in some ways it's fiction, and in other ways it's autobiography. It's suffused with yearning for a different family, you say, that this novel, Little Women, is. Talk a little bit about the difference between the fiction, you know, what's real, what's not, what's been changed.
Well, I think Little Women is a very complicated book in that way, and that teasing the fiction apart from the fact is something that is still going on. For instance, Orchard House, which is in Concord, Massachusetts, which gets, you know, tens of thousands, 100,000 visitors a year, was not actually the house where Louisa and her three sisters grew up. The house where Louisa and her three sisters grew up, oddly enough, is next door, and nobody ever goes there. So people who go to Orchard House are actually visiting the fictional March sisters. Louisa set Little Women at Orchard House. She wrote it when she was living at Orchard House later. But people get confused, and they think that the events in Little Women happened in Orchard House, but the real-life events in Little Women didn't. They happened down the street at the wayside. So it's very complicated, but it's certainly not autobiographical in the sense that it depicts in any way the many, many hardships and difficulties that family had to go through. And I think it's pretty easy to see that although Louisa thought she was just writing about her family, she called them the pathetic family, she thought she was just writing down what happened. In fact, what she wrote down was what she wished had happened. She wished that Joe had been beloved by all. But of course, Louisa, who was the Joe character, was not beloved by all. She was constantly being punished and berated for her rebellion and for her temper and for everything else about her, including the color of her hair. So it wasn't, you know, the picture in Little Women is not at all what really happened. But even in Little Women, she invents a household servant, Hannah, to do exactly the jobs which Louisa actually had to do in real life. So there are some parallels. There are four sisters in Little Women. There is a somewhat feckless, very absent father in Little Women. There is a sort of loving and bossy mother in Little Women, all of which happened. But in fact, the Alcotts had been through hell time and time again as a family, literally starving to death, literally not knowing how they would go on. And that's not in Little Women.
They had tremendous adversity, as you just said. She had tremendous personal adversity also in her family. Do you think without her rebellion, without that adversity, she would have been able to write such a passionate book?
I'm not sure what you're suggesting. But since it's a book about rebellion, obviously not. I don't think that adversity necessarily makes good writing, if that's what you're suggesting. But clearly the genius of Joe March as a character is that she's very rebellious, but yet she is loved. And in real life, the rebel is not loved. In real life, the rebel in the family is a huge annoyance. And in real life, the rebel in the family, just by definition, sets herself or himself at odds with the authority of the family. But in Little Women, somehow, the person who sets herself at odds with the authority of the family is nevertheless beloved. And I think that's what makes, one of the things that makes that character so powerful, is the fantasy that we can question authority and still be loved by authority.
Yeah, maybe, and not in all cases, adversity doesn't lead to great writing, but I think you do imply in the book that in Louisa May Alcott's case, it did, because it was not just her family's poverty, the conflicts within the family, but also her experience in the Civil War and how it changed her life, how it led to her own illness. Talk a little bit now about her, you know, why did she become a nurse in the Civil War? What happened to her?
Well, again, I'm not sure this is a case of adversity begetting talent, but the Alcotts were fervent abolitionists. Their house was a stop on the Underground Railroad. They were, you know, wild to do something to help the Union Army in the Civil War. They believed as deeply as anyone can believe that slavery was wrong and a travesty. And Bronson Alcott was, you know, a very, very active part of all the anti-slavery organizations in Boston. And Louisa wanted to help, but clearly she couldn't be a soldier. So she got herself a job as a Civil War nurse at the Union Hotel Hospital in Washington, D.C. And she was terrified. 2 days after she got there, the Battle of Fredericksburg occurred, which was one of the worst battles in the Civil War and the worst battle for the Union Army. So all of a sudden, this woman who had probably never seen a naked man was inundated, you know, with hundreds of wounded and dying men. And at first, she was terrified and hid, but she found that she loved nursing. And it wasn't an adversity for her. She found that it suited her very well when the stakes were that high, that she could help men die and write letters to their families and read them the letters from their families and tell them stories and take their mind off their pain. And, you know, soon she became a very important nurse at the Union Hospital, and that is indeed where she found her voice, I think, in Hospital Sketches, which is really the first place where we see the voice of Little Women, the voice of Louisa May Alcott, as we know it, the direct, very wry, very vivid voice. That voice comes first in the letters that she writes home from the Civil War and in Hospital Sketches. So she does find her voice. And certainly it's an adversity to be working as a Civil War nurse during the worst battles of the Civil War, but she loved it. There was something about her ability to tell stories and amuse people and to face up to life and death that really brought out the best in her. And, of course, she got terribly sick. She got pneumonia, and they gave her Calomel, which is what they gave in those days, which is mercury. So on top of whatever she had originally, she got severe mercury poisoning, and she almost died, and Bronson Alcott had to go down to Washington and get her and bring her home, and he wasn't sure if she would make it home. So two things happened to her at the Union Hospital. One was this almost ecstatic experience of finding a place in the world where she really felt useful and helpful and important. And the other was finding her voice.
We're talking about Louisa May Alcott and the writing of Little Women. Our guest is Susan Cheever. Her new book is Louisa May Alcott, A Personal Biography. And then that illness, in fact, I mean, it ruined her health for the rest of her life. You talk a lot about the illnesses that she had, and you also do a little exploration into how we look back, how people of our time have tried to diagnose her illness, figure out exactly what happened, because there was probably more than just the mercury poisoning. And you have some questions about that process.
Well, I'm a biographer who doesn't believe that it's okay to assume that we know much more than people knew in the 1860s. In other words, I think if you're going to write about people, you have to honor the context in which they lived. I'm very isolated in this way. You know, diagnosing Louisa May Alcott after the fact, both her physical and her mental disorders, has sort of become a cottage industry. You know, one biographer said she was manic depressive. Another one said she has lupus. A third one, you know, the truth is we don't have a lot of evidence about these things. And I also don't think it's useful. In other words, Louisa May Alcott thought that she was permanently poisoned by the mercury. I can see that that doesn't make a lot of sense, but I think it's important just to say that and let it sit. I don't think we need a 21st century diagnosis of a 19th century woman.
Talking about her biographers, you also say that there's a malleability of events. It's almost a Rashomon-like process to read these different biographies because everyone has a different take on things. You, as a biographer, what were you trying to do? What was your unique contribution that you wanted to make?
Well, one of the things I was able to do, I mean, biography is sort of the last conventional form. Most other forms in the last 20 years have been dramatically changed, or 30 years, let's say. A biography, however, is still, for the most part, exactly what it was 200 years ago. And I think that that's beginning to change. I think that biographers are beginning to look for new ways to present a person's life, Cleopatra being a very good example. You know, look for ways to allow biography to grow the way some other fictional and non-fictional forms have grown. I hope that my take on Louisa May Alcott was an objective take. What I was able to do that no other biographer had done was to consider the other biographies. In other words, biography is not, it's never objective. The choice of details, of course, is what gives the reader the impression the reader gets, and the biographer chooses the details. So, you know, I can say Bronson Alcott was tall and glamorous and brilliant, or I can say he was, you know, feckless and irresponsible and a bad writer. And both sets of facts are true, but I, the biographer, get to choose which facts I put in and which facts I leave out. So biography, I believe, is as personal and often as intimate as memoir, because you, the biographer, choose the facts that tell the story that you want to tell. It's really not so different from fiction. You have many, many facts available to you, many more than you can possibly use if you've done any research at all, and you use the facts that reflect your opinion. So I think it's important to say that. I think most biography pretends that there's only one set of facts and that the biography is working from that set of facts. But that's, you know, anybody can see that's not true. And Louisa May Alcott is a very good example of this because there have been so many biographies. But if you take the five most important biographies, as I did, it's very interesting to see how each biographer uses different details and draws different conclusions from the same details.
And also for you, I mean, you insert yourself into this biography, you know, the impact that Little Women had on you.
That's the preface. I actually tried not to insert myself in this book very much. I mean, I wrote a very personal preface, no question. But in the book itself, I make what I call some cameo appearances.
Yeah, and you also draw some parallels. You say that Louisa May Alcott was wrestling with many of the same issues that women wrestle with today, and I hesitate to challenge you, but in that I hear your voice, a very strong voice.
Well, you can hear my voice, but I certainly think it's true.
And what are those issues that she wrestled with that women still do?
I think women still have to decide how they're going to support themselves and their children and how they're going to navigate that. Are they going to try to marry a man who they may not love, like, say, Laurie in Little Women, because he provides financial security? Or are they going to try to develop their own career and support themselves and their children, which is very, very difficult for women to do, by the way, and then marry whoever they like? Or are they going to try to... how are they going to navigate that? I mean, every woman today has a choice, a series of choices, hundreds of choices that she has to make, and that she will make about that. In other words, if you want the basic domestic comforts, how are you going to afford them? That's the question that women face. And it's exactly the same question that they faced in 1868.
And in fact, Louisa May Alcott decided not to marry.
She did decide not to marry.
Well, it's a wonderful book. Louisa May Alcott, A Personal Biography. I want to thank you so much, Susan Cheever, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. It was a terrific book. I enjoyed it hugely.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Susan Cheever. Stay tuned for our interview with Susan Cheever about her previous book, American Bloomsbury, coming up in the second half of the show. You can read an excerpt of Louisa May Alcott by going to writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Don't go away. Back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the first half of the show, we talked to author Susan Cheever about her latest book, her acclaimed biography of Louisa May Alcott. Now let's listen to my 2007 interview with her about her history of a genius cluster of great American writers gathered around Ralph Waldo Emerson in 19th century Concord, Massachusetts. The book is American Bloomsbury, Louisa May Alcott, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Margaret Fuller, and Henry David Thoreau, their lives, their loves, their work. Cheever said the group invented a new kind of American literature. Now, you say that these folks were the first professional authors. What do you mean by that?
Well, they were the first group of American writers. I mean, there were professional authors in England, but they were the first professional authors in the United States. I mean, before them, there were not people who made a living writing books. It was sort of a new idea, and it was part of this whole explosion of creativity and joy, really, which happened in New England in the 1840s and 50s, which was quite extraordinary, and very much like what happened in this country in the 1960s. There was this kind of outpouring of freedom, and, you know, Emerson's essay, Self-Reliance, was really part of this emphasis on the individual, which was brand new. And I think that until then, in other words, the revolution was in 1776, and so it took about 50 years for it to sink in that we could enjoy European things without being afraid of being dominated by Europe, and that we could have a love affair with nature instead of thinking of nature as a terrible enemy that we needed to beat down in order to survive. And we could imagine a God who existed in other people or in nature instead of a punishing
Puritan God. So all these things kind of came together at once. You know, you even had Nathaniel Hawthorne saying, I want my own thing. He didn't say I want to do my own thing, but he practically did.
And of course, Thoreau said, turn on, tune in, and drop out, although maybe he didn't say turn on. Now, you know, you mentioned the 60s, and I've thought often that it was a kind of a resurgence of American Romanticism that was like German Romanticism or even the Rousseauian French Romanticism. And when I read your book, it occurred to me that this was an earlier connection there. Can you say that this was like an American Romantic movement allied
exactly.
to those?
Exactly. That's what it is. It's the first American Romantic movement, and it was quite electrifying. I mean, and for the first time, intellectuals went back and forth from England, and Margaret Fuller brought German literature to Concord. So all these, it was extremely exciting, and I think that people felt, or certainly writers felt, and intellectuals felt, and poets felt that, you know, for the first time they were able to plumb the landscape of the human heart. Because before that, it had really been about surviving and surviving as the United States.
And they were called the Transcendentalists. What were they transcending, and why were they transcending it?
You know, there's a huge amount of discussion about what transcendentalism means, and no real conclusion. But clearly, what they transcended were the old Puritan ways. All the rules and regulations about society, certainly all the rules and regulations about what you can and can't believe when it comes to God. Emerson gave a very famous speech at the Harvard Divinity School, which got him kicked out of Harvard for 30 years, saying that essentially God is everywhere. So transcending those old strictures about, you know, what God was and what God wasn't. And also, to some extent, you know, they transcended these rules about marriage and these rules about what women did and what women didn't do. You know, it was about transcending the old ways, the old rules and regulations, and coming to a new understanding of what it meant to be human in this beautiful place. And certainly Margaret Fuller, for instance, transcended very much the idea of what it had meant to be a woman. Of course, everybody believed in those days that women were inferior in every way. And, you know, Margaret Fuller was the editor of the Herald Tribune. She was a foreign correspondent. She didn't get married, you know. And
she had a child out of wedlock.
She had a child out of wedlock. She, you know, fell in love with who she pleased. She did what she pleased. She was educated as if she was a man, which is to say she was educated at all. But, you know, at the same time, they thought it was a big deal to let her use the Harvard Library. So, you know, the idea of a woman even going to Harvard was just not dreamt of in their philosophy. They transcended really the old ways, and they called it the newness or the awakening, and I think it felt that way. I think it was a very exciting time to be alive.
You're listening to Writer's Voice on Valley Free Radio. Visit our website at www.writersvoice.net. You can find links to our podcast there, which is also podcasting on Valley Free Radio, as well as other links and information about the show and the show's guests. Now, Susan Cheever, you paint a picture of a new sensual and even sexual freedom. Certainly, there is a whole kind of undercurrent of eroticism that you talk about in the book, and a lot of multiple and even intersecting love triangles. But you also call them high-minded prudes, where, you know, this was a time when even table legs were hidden. You know, in other words, there are a lot of contradictions here. Give us some examples first of who was in love with whom, and then talk about how they worked with these kind of contradictory elements.
Well, I think the high-minded prudes were not, I think these people were not in general high-minded prudes. In other words, I think the prudishness was really what they were trying to put behind them. You know, the people who felt that you couldn't hang clothes on the line without putting a pillowcase over the clothes left men see ladies under things. I think that you know, the transcendentalists, if we're going to call them that, were very much trying to get away from that. But the love triangles are sort of interesting. Because it was such a close-knit and intimate community, there was a great deal, and I'm using the word love and the word love affair not literally, but there was a great deal of intimate connection. Both of the Thoreau brothers fell in love with the same woman, and first John Thoreau proposed to her and she turned him down, and then Henry David Thoreau proposed to her and she turned him down. And then both Nathaniel Hawthorne and Ralph Waldo Emerson were very involved with Margaret Fuller, to the extent where Emerson got so jealous that he, you know, had the Hawthorns kicked out of Concord, essentially. And then Thoreau lived at the Emerson's house, and he and Mrs. Emerson became very close friends, especially when Emerson would be gone for a year. In fact, that's how Thoreau ended up going to Walden. He had been living at the Emerson's for a year while Emerson was abroad, and the Emerson children adored Thoreau. All children adored Thoreau, and Emerson's wife, Lydian, loved Thoreau, and he loved her, and Emerson came home, and of course, the house was way too small for the Emerson / Thoreau family and the Emerson family. So Emerson said to Thoreau, you know, you can't stay here. And Thoreau said, well, I don't really have anywhere to go. And Emerson said, well, you know, I have a woodlot I just bought out on Walden Pond for $89. Why don't you go out there and build a cabin and live out there for a while? And that's why Thoreau went out there. He wasn't intending to be a hermit. He just didn't have anywhere else to live.
You just said, you don't say love affair literally. So there is a way in which I think there these heated passions, you even suggest that they may have been as heated as they were because you don't think that they were consummated.
I don't think that they were, but I'm not sure. And I think all scholars and unscholars of these people very much wish that there was more documentation on this. But I certainly couldn't find it. I mean, I looked, you know, I imagined finding a letter from Emerson to Margaret Fuller, but I didn't find it. It's at the moment not there, although letters are turning up all the time. Actually, in the last 6 months,
really
interesting things have turned up. Yes, Thoreau, as you know, at one point built a fire in an old stump to roast some fish and set fire to Concord, to 300 acres of it. And some of the people whose land was burned, letters have just surfaced of theirs. So, you know, things are still coming to light in people's attics, the famous New England attic. And then I just learned, you know, the famous story of how Louisa came to write Little Women.
Yes, tell our listeners that. That was quite a surprise.
Yes. Well, that was one of the first things I came on back when I was starting with this. But she had written a novel called Moods, which she thought was a wonderful novel and her breakthrough novel. And it was about a woman very much like her who was in love with a man very much like Emerson and another man very much like Thoreau, and the agony of her choice. And she thought it was going to be the novel that put her on the map as a serious literary person, and it didn't. And it also got a very bad review from Henry James, who said the ignorance of this writer about human nature is equaled only by the confidence of this writer in what she knows about human nature. I mean, a really mean review. Anyway, she then went down to Washington to work in a hospital during the Civil War, which was a really life-changing experience for her. And of course, she also got very sick down there and was given medication that made her even sicker. And she came home, and then she wrote a little book called Hospital Sketches about her time in Washington, in which I think she really found her mature style. And then she wanted to write another significant novel. So she went to her editor, Thomas Niles of Tickner and Fields, and she said to him, okay, I want to write a really significant novel. And he said, well, I can't sell a book like that you would write. And she said, well, what could you sell? And he said, well, the only thing I could possibly sell that you could write would be a book for young girls. And she said, absolutely not. She said, after everything I've been through, I am not going to go back and write children's literature. So he said, well, too bad. That's the only thing I'll publish. And she, you know, in a complete sort of fit, and she had been very discouraged before, so she was used to having people tell her that she couldn't do what she needed to do as an artist. But anyway, she went to Boston. She turned him down and went to Boston. And what Thomas Niles did was he wrote to Louisa's father, Bronson Alcott. And this is a letter I just saw for the first time about a month ago. He wrote Bronson a letter saying, you know, I really wish that Louisa would write this book for young women, and I think I would be able to, you know, pay her enough to make a difference to your family. And of course, Bronson, if she was to write this book for young women, I'm sure I could see my way to publishing a book of yours.
Wow.
So it was a double bribe. Mm-hmm. And Bronson wrote to Louisa and sort of summoned her home, and she was in a rage. She felt violated as a writer. She felt that she was going against all her creative instincts. She was very sick. She was a spinster. She had given up everything for this hungry family of origin that she came from. And she went back to Concord in a rage and sat down at the stinky little desk that her father had built for her, just in a fury, and, as I say, very sick. So sick that she couldn't write with her right hand. She had to learn to write with her left hand. And in about 6 weeks, she wrote, you know, one of the best-selling books of all time.
And we're talking with Susan Cheever about her book, American Bloomsbury. You know, there's a wonderful passage in your book. Do you have your book with you there?
Yes, I do.
Because you describe what it was like for her to write this book.
Sure.
I wonder if you could read those paragraphs, starting when she looked up during the day, and if you could read it down to her teacher and friend Thoreau.
Okay, yeah, this is chapter 47, so...
Or maybe actually down to across the hall, the three paragraphs. That
okay,
great.
When she looked up during the day, past the rustic board fence her father had built at the edge of the property, she saw people in carriages passing on the Lexington Road, and beyond the road, pastures sparkling with wildflowers. When she rode at night by candlelight, she communed with a family of barred owls that lived in the broad branches of the huge elm tree outside her windows. As she wrote during the day, she could sometimes look down from the window and see her father, not working in the gardens behind the house, but sitting on the bench with a pile of his finest red pippin, apples, waiting for the occasional traveler who might be ready for a dose of his own brand of high philosophical discourse. Sometimes Emerson dropped by. Sometimes Alcott would entertain a special visitor from Boston, like Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, or Franklin Sanborn would wander up the Lexington Road to talk pedagogy, or one of the Hawthorne children would come over from next door. Beyond the meadows lay the shimmering water of Walden Pond and the fields and marshes where Louisa had taken so many passionate walks so long ago with her teacher and friend Thoreau. The little half-moon-shaped desk her father had built for her sat at the foot of Louisa's bed, surrounded by her books in a crowded cabinet bookcase, her sewing basket, family portraits, flower paintings by her older sister Anna, and a bust of the poet Schiller on the mantel. Although Orchard House was unheated except by fireplaces, and the Alcotts in later years often closed it up for the winter and moved to Boston, Louisa's room had a fireplace and windows facing south and west toward Concord. Her parents slept in the bedroom across the hall.
Could you say, how did you get this level of detail? I mean, some of the things, you know, about Bronson Alcott, I'm sure it was pretty well known with him and his apples, but how did you get these details?
The details about Louisa's bedroom, I was just thinking as I read them, it's a photograph.
It's in the book, too, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Essentially, I'm describing a photograph of her bedroom, including the bust of Schiller. And so in this case, a lot of the details come from photographs. A lot of the detail in my book came from letters and journals. And God bless these people, because they all wrote extensive letters and journals, just so extensive, so detailed about the furniture and what they ate and what they wore and what they did and the weather. And so it's possible to recreate a lot of scenes with pretty good detail.
And as you point out also, of course, so much of what Thoreau put into Walden came from his journals. You quote a wonderful sentence, I went into the woods to live deliberately so that I might, from the essential facts of things, and might not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. You credit him with simultaneously inventing the memoir and the nature book.
Well, I think he did. I mean, Walden is sort of the first American memoir, and it took him 9 years to get Walden published, which is one reason why it's so good. He rewrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it. But it's definitely written from memory, and he also wrote the nature book. I mean, that's what Walden is as well. But to go back to it being a memoir, Walden is very full of Thoreau's personality, and he was a very crotchety type. He hated rich people. He felt that it was never okay to drink alcohol. He was a strict vegetarian. He had some very crotchety ideas. He did not like taking charity. He had taken enough charity for a lifetime. And those ideas, you know, he used Walden to kind of express his own personality through recalled anecdotes and images, which is, I think, a definition of memoir.
Right. And I was also surprised that, I mean, he's such a great figure now, but he never achieved any kind of success or recognition, really, other than from the people who knew him when he was alive. And you mentioned Walden. It was an absolute bust.
It was, yes. It was.
Why?
I mean, mm-hmm. Well, they didn't get it, you know? I mean, it wasn't... I mean, you know, The Scarlet Letter was a huge bestseller, and Little Women was a huge bestseller, and Walden was a very strange book. I mean, everybody thought that Thoreau was going to be the sad acolyte of James Russell Lowell when history was written. But
and
of course,
who was that?
Exactly. That's not how it turned out. But Walden is such an extraordinary book, and I do think it is so extraordinary because it was rewritten so often.
And it, you know, he really was, is the word avatar? I mean, he was really ahead of his time.
He really was. He really was.
And it, ahead of his time by about 100 years.
Yes. Although he wasn't so much ahead of his time as ahead of our intelligence.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean... the things he wrote about were true then, you know, that you can find more solace in nature than you can in many things, that leading a simple life is a good thing to do for many, many reasons, that closeness to nature and the rhythms of nature are healing, that charity is awful, that it doesn't work, and it only feels good to the giver and not to the receiver. You know, many of the things he wrote about were true then and are true now. We just didn't see it. I mean, it was just the reading public that failed to understand what a brilliant book it is.
You also say that both with Walden and with Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, that the impetus to write these masterpieces came with despair.
Well, and that's true of Little Women, too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the reasons I wrote the book, of course, was to find out for myself what was behind this genius cluster of writers so that I could do what they did and write a masterpiece myself, I mean, of course. And what I found horrified me. What I found was that, it's certainly in those three cases, that the greatest work comes from really having nothing left to lose. And I hope that's not true. But if you look at Walden and The Scarlet Letter and Little Women, it's very interesting that these people were really, I mean, Hawthorne had given up writing, you know. They really were in a very dark place when these extraordinary works were written by them. I thought it was very interesting. And what's even more interesting is that I don't think Louisa May Alcott ever wrote a book again that was as good as Little Women.
Or before.
Nor did Hawthorne write a book again as good as The Scarlet Letter. Nor did Thoreau write another book. So it does suggest to me that although there perhaps isn't this big link that everybody thinks there is between writing and drinking and womanizing and carrying on, that there does seem to be a link between kind of intense creativity and really having nothing left to lose, really being at a point in your life where you just are ready to risk everything on, you know, a roll of the pen.
So you're kind of saying is this tortured genius theory is true?
Well, no, they weren't tortured. They were done.
Uh-huh. It's the giving up.
It's the giving up, I think, that sometimes creates the astonishing thing. But another thing to be said about both Hawthorne and Louisa is that because they had given up and because they had both been through quite difficult passages in their life. I mean, Hawthorne lost his mother and got fired from his job, which he had only taken because he had given up writing, and then lost Margaret Fuller, who certainly was alive in his imagination, and Louisa had really lost everything. And in both those books, there's such a sublime quality of yearning for something that's been lost, yearning for something that didn't happen. I mean, Little Women, it just, to me, you can almost smell it coming off the page. I mean, that is the family that Louisa May Alcott so desperately, desperately wanted to have.
The one that was like her family, but the version she wished it had been.
Exactly. Because it wasn't really like her family that much at all.
Right.
You know, I mean, Louisa was the rebel, but she was not loved for being a rebel. She was disliked for being a rebel.
And her family was grindingly poor rather than genteelly poor.
Exactly. And she made up a servant, for instance, Hannah. It's complete fictitious. You know, and her sister's death was not a calm letting go, but rather a desperate, horrible. So I think it was close enough to what had happened so that she was just desperately yearning for it to be as it was. And I think Hawthorne also was very affected by Margaret Fuller, by her having an illegitimate child, by her death, and it just is yearning for her. And I think that sometimes intense yearning can be a tremendous goad to creativity, and that's a little more bearable information than having to think that you have to let go of absolutely everything, although that's probably true too.
And so have you been able to use that in your writing? Or do you anticipate using it?
Well, I have such a yearning for Concord. It's interesting. There's something about Concord, Massachusetts, and I'd like to write about Concord again. I feel a sort of yearning for Concord. You know, that lazy river, the willows brushing the water, all those things.
Well, Susan Cheever, it's a wonderful, fascinating story that you tell in American Bloomsbury, and I want to thank you so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
The book is American Bloomsbury, Louisa May Alcott, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Margaret Fuller, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Henry David Thoreau, Their Lives, Their Loves, Their Work. Susan Cheever is also the author of the memoir As Good as I Could Be, published in 2001, as well as numerous other books. You can go to the Writer's Voice website at writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from American Bloomsbury.
What must happen? But can you let it? You understand, but do you get it? Do you know yourself as friend or foe? People never change, but sometimes they grow. eyes closed. We all know God and death, I suppose. Memory fails my prophesizing pen. To know your past is to know. Your certainty drives you crazy. It can happen inside, it can happen out. The only comfort is found within the doubt. Every corner I turn to see, poets and authors have been there before me. Never a thought or a feeling goes on without the place we all come from. Away, they just keep coming back round my way. I stumble on guilt, on those who don't care. I stumble on fear, I think I'll find.
That's the song Poets and Authors on the album Going Home by Druid Roots. Looking for some good summer reading? Here are two novels to pack for the beach. One is Jennifer Haig's Faith, out from HarperCollins. Taking the sexual abuse scandals in Boston's Catholic diocese as its background, the book is a suspenseful exploration of one man's guilt or innocence, as seen through the eyes of his devoted sister. The Washington Post's Ron Charles wrote, Haig brings a refreshing degree of humanity to a story you think you know well, and in chapters both riveting and profound, she catches the avalanche of guilt this tragedy unleashes in one devout family. My other summer reading recommendation is Siri Hustvedt's The Summer Without Men. It may be the best novel I've read so far this year. It's about a 55-year-old poet, Mia, whose husband of 30 years decides to take a pause from his marriage to be with another woman. After a brief grief-induced nervous breakdown, Mia returns to her hometown to spend the summer near her elderly mother, who's in a senior living facility. The women she meets each have something to teach her, from the girls in the teen writing group she runs, to a young mother next door, to a needlepoint artist of advanced age who reveals some remarkable and racy artistic talents. As one reviewer wrote, for a novel concerned in greater part with pain, rejection, madness, and encroaching death, it's an astoundingly joyful read, an apparently artless jumble of scenes, memories, letters, and emails, scraps of poetry, rhetorical riffs. Look for my interviews with Jennifer Haig and Siri Hustvedt on Writer's Voice in the coming months. And meanwhile, check out the novels Faith by Jennifer Haig and A Summer Without Men by Siri Hustvedt. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.